You know, contrary to popular belief, which says that Bengalis are never good entrepreneurs, so they never start a business. You know, both Kallol and I are the laziest Bengalis. Even you know, the bar is quite high for Bengalis and being lazy. But we've been like unbelievably lazy. I mean, Kallol trumps even me. But
hello and welcome. I'm Shashank Mehta, founder at The Whole Truth Foods. As the founder of a young startup, I've seen firsthand the immense challenges that come with starting and scaling a company. No founder can be fully prepared for what entrepreneurship looks like. But we can definitely learn from the giants who've come before us. Stalwart founders who've built great companies and who've perhaps faced those very same challenges and overcome them. On this podcast, I speak to them, founder to founder, and try and unearth the whole truth of starting up. Let's begin. In today's episode, we have Jaideep Barman, founder at The Rebel Foods. Hey folks, today we have with us Jaideep Barman. Jaideep is the founder of Rebel Foods, which was previously called Fasos. Over the last 9 years, he's built the world's largest internet restaurant company, and he's done this with a team of entrepreneurs, not a team of CXOs. Jaideep is also a mountaineer, and since the journey of building and scaling a startup is nothing short of scaling a mountain, today we'll talk to him about both these extremely tough things that he's chosen to do in life. So welcome, Jaideep, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. Thank you for having me here, Shashank.
Awesome. Jaideep, okay, to begin with, for our viewers, I just want to give them some background that I was one of the first EIRs or entrepreneurs in residence at Rebel. And it's an idea that's so appealed to me that today all of The Whole Truth is also populated by EIRs. So from the man who introduced me to the idea, Jaideep, what is an EIR and why did you think of hiring them?
Like most of the things at Rebel, I was like stuck with something, which was I was stuck with a couple of people who we hired from traditional backgrounds, etc. And I was stuck with these people kind of. And, you know, I still remember a particular conversation when we asked one of these guys to open Bangalore. I mean, he goes there 15 days, comes back and says, okay, Bangalore is a tough market to enter. We can't do that. So that's like, you know, that's when we, Kallol and I, Kallol is my co-founder, as you know, and for the benefit of the other guys who's listening in, we decided that we need to have a different breed of people. And over time, this got formed in more defined shape in my mind. You know, I realized that there are three things that you need to do something pioneering and as a team. Like if you are taking a franchise of McDonald's or a retail store of, Vodafone, then you don't need, that sort of thinking. But when you're starting something new, charting new grounds, I realized that you need, I believe three things. One is ownership, like really owning the failures and the results and the successes and everything. Second is an ability to figure out things. Like, and if you have like 20 years of experience, one particular thing, then you probably lose that DNA of figuring out new things, you know, in an uncertain environment where nobody in the world knows the right answer, right? There is no blueprint. So you got to figure it out yourself. So that's the second piece. And the third, I actually think is the most important one, which is what I call a founder mentality. Like a founder mentality is something which is different from building a CV mentality. Like, so if you hire a like 20 year experienced CMO, then that person is always thinking, you know, how can I further my CV? And not all, but you know, most cases I've seen. So this founder mentality I define by people who are not building their CV, who are willing to take on new challenges, you know, willing to hire people at a higher salary than themselves, you know, all of the things that I have done, you know, as a founder, and a lot of founders, you may have also done, and you know, things like that, and reporting to each other rather than thinking, okay, you know, we joined at the same time, you know, how can I report to someone else and things like that, like putting the company ahead of oneself. So in my mind, this ownership, ability, and attitude to figure shit out, and then finally, you know, this founder mentality. This is what I was looking for all the time, and I'm so happy that you know, I could hire, you know, seven of you at that point in time, actually eight of you at that point in time, and five of them have been made co-founders at Rebel. And then the three of you who left to my Chargen have founded your own companies. So I guess there is some success there for me.
I think that's an insane success rate. And as I go about now trying to replicate that similar model, the toughest thing I find is, how do you test for founder mentality in an interview or, you know, while hiring? Like, how do you do that?
So one thing that we have always done from AFR days, and you will remember this, we never asked for CVs. We asked for a write-up with a couple of questions. One is, you know, why do you want to come to Rebel? And, you know, second is, tell us something that you have realized in your life from first principle. And things like that. Over time, the questions have changed a little bit, but the essence remained. Like, when you write long form answers, your true self sort of comes out. And that's a belief. I don't know how true that is, but I have seen it when I read someone's, you know, long form writing. I have a peek into that person's, you know, inner self. And that has not failed me so far. So that's one. And secondly, one of the questions that I always ask in the interview is, a lot of people ask, you know, what are your strengths? You know, what have you been successful at? Things like that. But I always remember to ask, you know, what was your biggest failure? And then I've seen people, you know, talk about failures in two sorts of ways. So one is, you know, blaming the world that, you know, I had a bad boss or the company's vision was not right and blah, blah, blah. And then there would be people who would be saying that it was my fault, you know, it is the decision I took and it didn't go the right way. And I learned XYZ from that. And that to me is a big differentiating factor between people with founder mentality and the ones without that mentality. So these are the couple of things that we have done. And so far, with FERs, I was like 100% successful, but then with leaders, I won't say I was 100% successful, but more often than not, we got the right people on board.
Do you also think that actually the success rate is also defined by what happens once they join, and it's not just about what they bring on board, like what place they're joining and the culture that they find there is also an equal factor into whether you finally say, oh yes, this was a successful hire because they stayed for that long, or are they the input?
I think it's both. I think input, you know, is obviously very important. I mean, fundamentally, when you are like 20 plus years, you don't change as a person, right? So you learn new things and so on and so forth, but fundamentally you probably don't change. But I believe we've also created an atmosphere to breed entrepreneurship or founder mentality. And it, you know, contrary to popular belief, which says that Bengalis are never good entrepreneurs, so they never start a business. You know, both Kallol and I are the laziest Bengalis. Even you know, the bar is quite high for Bengalis and being lazy. But we've been like unbelievably lazy. I mean, Kallol trumps even me, but fundamentally, when that happens, then you tell someone or you say, okay, who's going to do X, Y, Z? And that guy or girl says, okay, I'm going to do this. And then you're like, okay, you know, let him or her do it, you know, figure it out. Not always behind them and not micromanaging. You know, sometimes obviously things happen and you would remember some of the incidents from our days together where I would go berserk and, you know, I would become the nastiest asshole in the world. But largely I left people to do, you know, and build and, you know, on their own. And we sort of performance manage people through not only sort of numbers, but also the values. Over time, we built our, you know, four or five values that are very important for us. Display of those values. You know, we created 360 degree feedback where people rate one another on those values and things like that. And both performance and values started becoming equally important for being successful at Rebel. So those are, so I would say, you know, this independence that we could provide, this, you know, value-centric performance management system that we could build, where some of the reasons where where this thing worked out.
Okay, in the spirit of the whole truth, I'm not going to let you get away with saying that you're a lazy guy. So everyone must know that Jaideep is one of the hardest workers and the hardest pushers that I've ever found in life. So you're not definitely not a lazy guy. But the question I want to ask on this point is, you know, as you said that you leave people to do and figure things out. And that is a slow process, right? People who've never done this in the past make a lot of mistakes, go down the wrong paths, then backtrack, course correct, etc. I understand how that works in the long term, which is why I'm also bought into it. But life in a startup is also very focused on the short term. There's investor pressure. You need to grow. You need to show certain numbers, do the next fundraise, all of that stuff. Have you never felt tempted to give into the lure of getting some guy who's, you know, done this for 10 years, who can come in and hit some quick sixers and you know, get some quick traction? How do you balance, you know, that outlook with the fact that, hey, I know what I'm doing is great for the long term when these guys figure it out, but for now we are suffering?
See, I think, you know, first of all, when you're doing something new, in your case, making the world a place for better food or something like that. I'm forgetting the exact tagline, but bringing world's faith back in food or something like that, right?
Rebuilding the world's trust in its food, yes.
Trust in its food, correct. Yeah. So that means you're doing something pioneering, right? And I'm a big fan of Whole Truth, right? Even my daughters have become big fans. I'll tell you, one of your investors had called me and said, you know, we were thinking of investing in Shashank, but he seems to be little, little stuck in his views and little unreasonable. And my answer to that was, you know, name a brand which has been built by reasonable people. You know, there is nothing like that, right? So, you know, Steve Jobs was not reasonable. Bezos is not reasonable. You know, Larry Page and all, none of these guys, even Sachin Bansal was not reasonable. And none of them had 10 years of experience of doing something. The prerequisite for building something new is that you, or the, I would say that the most important thing about this is that you not having that experience, because experience brings reason. You know, you think, okay, this has not happened there. You know, I saw this thing working there and this thing not working there. When you are bogged down by things like that, which, you know, reason brought around by experience, you don't build anything pioneering. You know, it has never happened. You don't see, I'm sorry, you've been at Unilever. You don't see Unilever CEOs building the best D2C brands. So where, if you're doing something, you are starting a business which has been done to death in the past, like let's say a McDonald's franchisee, as I was saying, then you would rather have a guy who knows how to do it, right? Has 10 years of experience. But when you're fundamentally building something new, what use of that experience? So that's one. And secondly, over time, you would realize that there are some functions where you don't need to reinvent the wheel. There you are not pioneering, like finance, like accounting. You know, that would be crazy, right? Like, you know, changing the, you know, accounting world or something like that. So there you would need at some point in time people coming in. And we have also done that. You know, we've hired a CFO. And obviously, he has to tick the other boxes of, he or she has to tick the other boxes of ownership and things like that. But for those things, you would like supply chain, you know, you don't need to reinvent that wheel, right? But everything else, like in my mind, two things. At any point in time in your startup, you'll have 0 to 1 projects, which is adjacencies. Should we now launch Moosely, for example? So you would need 0 to 1 guys for those things. You would need founder mentality for general management positions, but you would need, you know, probably veterans for your specific functional knowledge is like, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is finance. So, that would be my tip.
So definitely learning this exactly the way you're saying, the hard way, that doesn't apply to finance for sure. But there are some functions where I am seeing that you actually need a confluence, and I think you've also evolved into that. For example, product, where you need both skill set and expertise, and yet the 0-to-1 mentality. How do you manage those?
See, I think as I was saying, you know, the founders in your company or the people who are the entrepreneur kind, in the first few years, probably they would be doing everything, you know, product, tech, you know, all operations, marketing and everything. But over time, if you have great guys, then they will hire the experts in those fields. And that has happened in our case. So over time, because, and they would be ready to pay higher salary to these guys than the, you know, over themselves. They're okay, you know, because that's the founder mentality, right? I would need this particular expertise, so I'd hire. And over time, some of these guys who come on as a functional expert, let's say a product or a tech expert, they blossom. And then, you know, in the right atmosphere, because hiring for these guys are also based on the same philosophy, and they start, you know, taking over functions, etc. I mean, I know, again, a long shot example. If you think about who all succeeded, the founders in big companies, like who succeeded Bezos in Amazon, it's his first chief of staff, right? He's not a guy with 10 years of experience in technology or anything. Andy Jassy, who then built a 0-to-1 project and then 1-to-10 and now taking over. Same Sundar Pichai, same Satya Nadella. It's in none of these companies you would find an external hire with, like, you know, with massive experience coming and becoming the next CEO. So there is a place for, you know, functional expertise in whatever you are building, but it, as you said, it has to be, you know, guided by the sort of founder mentality at every stage.
As a young founder, I still struggle with this thought of, you know, when we need to hire functional experts who might come at higher salaries than the founding team, what will happen? And I love, you know, how actually wanting to do that is actually a litmus test of ownership and founder mindset. And you know, it's a journey for a founder to actually believe that, just like I think like a founder, sometimes I believe it's my own mental block that the team actually is exhibiting that same mindset. In my head, I have that mental block that ye to sirf main hi kar sakta hun ki mere se higher salary pe I will hire someone, and that's a huge impact on culture. But I want to ask you beyond that, now that you have a team of entrepreneurs at the top, what are the 2-3 big culture impacts that you see leading out of this hiring philosophy?
So I would say the one is ownership, you know, like ownership for success and failure. That really runs in our veins, you know, and there is no externalization in our company. Like, nobody says, okay, industry is going down, but we are disrupting the industry. So, you know, or, you know, some external, even COVID has happened, our sales are 80% down and this is what it is and we can't do anything about it. No, you know, we've been pioneering, we've had our share of bad luck and good luck and all of those things, but fundamentally we have to own, everybody has to own. So that's one, ownership. The second, I would say, this mentality of challenging the status quo, which is like, this is in a particular way things happen in the world or in the industry where we are or whatever work we are doing. Then how, you know, I don't see in our company anybody saying that this has not happened before. I don't remember, you know, hearing that anymore for a long, long time. You know, people are okay, you know, we have to change this, we have to rethink about this, let's do it. I mean, there is no talk about hasn't happened, so hence, you know, we don't know how to do it, etc. So that's the second one. And innovation and invention, all of that comes from there. And then the third, I think this has happened over time, not on day one, is over time we have become customer first. Like there are companies which are skills forward, right? You know, we know how to do this, and hence how can we translate this into a customer proposition? And that's a great thing. But I have witnessed our company becoming customer first, which is first thinking, okay, what the customer needs, and then working backward from there and finding new skills, and not saying, okay, this is a skill that we don't have, and this is the expertise that we don't have, so hence we can't do it. No, if the customer, like this is what we call inventing on behalf of the customer. So if you start from the customer, come backward, the realization could be, we don't have a particular skill, I'm going to build that skill. And we go ahead and do that. So I would say these are the three things that that have really blossomed at Rebel because of the way we build the team.
Superb. I want to change tack now and talk about you and another side of you that I don't know too many people know of, which is that you love climbing mountains. And while you scale Rebel, you also scale a few mountains by the side. Just first tell us about this. When did it start? Like how long have you been at it? What all peaks have you done?
Well, I mean, I'm no Edmund Hillary, just to clarify. I mean, it all started at engineering college, you know, in Jadavpur in Calcutta. We used to have a mountaineering club. And obviously, I used to be at the club more than at the classes. And that's how it started. It's like, you know, friends around you. And we used to go for climbing practices to one of the hill range close to Calcutta called Shushunia, which is in the district of Purulia, etc. So we'd go for the weekends, you know, that was much more interesting than, let's say, thermodynamics and things like that. So that's, you know, that's how it all started, you know, with being with the friends. And then we used to take a month long sort of trip to climb a trip, you know, out of my 4 years at engineering, I went on this trip 3 years and you know, climbed a peak or went to a particular altitude and things like that. So that's how it started. Over time, it became, you know, there was a hiatus of about, I would say, 10 years when I went for my MBA at NCR and then went to McKinsey. But then I started it again once I started Rebel, 3-4 years into Rebel. It became like going to new places like Nepal or Bhutan or Ladakh or Peruvian Andes and, you know, seeing new cultures, etc. And then off late, it has become more like, you know, finding silence, solitude, thinking time. So I would say over time, the motivation has changed. But this is something I absolutely love. And it has been with me with, you know, apart from that 10-year gap, forever now.
I know you've done some like decently big peaks compared to normal folks like us, maybe not Edmund Hillary, but some fairly decent ones, which requires both physical prep and some level of skill. And I assume that given how busy a life you lead, that this comes in spurts, that you decide that this year I'm going to go do this range and go to, Bhutan or the Andes, etc. Just talk us through the cadence and how do you train for it?
So I think there has to be a base cadence throughout the year. That's irrespective of whether I'm climbing in a particular year or not. So, and that is usually, you know, 5-6 hours of, 60% of that would be cardio, you know, and then maybe 20% leg strength, lower body, and then rest core and upper body. And this is a cadence that I maintain. I started maintaining over the last few years. Earlier when I was younger, you know, I didn't have to be in shape as much as I need to right now to continue to do mountaineering. So I do this, you know, 5-6 hours a week all year long. But then when there is a peak to be climbed or a new region, to go to, then I would take almost a 20-week preparation for that. So on top of that base training, I would increase the number of hours. So from 6-8 hours to, I think, 2 weeks before the climb, I would stop everything. And but, you know, till then, it'll typically go up to like 16, 17 hours a week. But also the combination changes. So initially, for the first 6-7 weeks, it's higher number of hours, but that same ratio of cardio, lower body core and strength, upper body. But then about 6 weeks before the climb, I would go to specific training, which is I would pack a 20 kilo, like with my weights on my rucksack, and I would go to, and that's one of the reasons I live in Pune. Within 2 hours of drive, you have like fantastic ranges where you can go really uphill with a 20 kilo pack on your back for a few hours, and you time yourselves. And those are the last, and those I would typically do in the weekends. So Saturday, Sunday. And then the rest of the days, the usual cardio and the other things I talked about. So, and then, you know, it almost goes like that and tapers down towards the end, and almost like marathon. I've never run a marathon, but I think also people train like that, you know, taper it off last week or so to be in, so the muscles are relaxed, and then you can hit the mountain in a better shape. So that is typically the routine.
Wow. So if I'm getting this right, the base training is 5-6 hours a week, which is almost an hour a day, which goes up to 2-2.5 hours a day. But I'm assuming that's not how it's split. It's like, is it one or two very strenuous days and the others 1 or 2 hours? Yeah. And the last 6 week rucksack climb, I'm assuming, is over a weekend or some such, right?
Usually starts with 1 day a weekend, but goes to subsequent days. So, you do a climb on Saturday, and then you repeat the climb on Sunday. Because it's all basically training your specific muscles for endurance, and you know, mountaineering is a multi-day activity, always upward, largely. So so those are the specific muscles that need to be trained. With a pack on your back, so yeah.
How do you find the time? That's a lot of time to devote.
I would say, you know, weekends, it's easier, as you know. And weekdays, I find 2 hours: 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening. Sometimes during lunchtime. The thing is, I think it has become a little bit like, if I don't do it, I feel bad. My meetings don't go well. You know, my productivity drops. So it's actually it has become the other way around, that to be at my best, you know, intellectually also, I find this very helpful. So it is no more that I have I have to find time to do this. It is like, if I don't do this, I don't do the other things well. So that's how I've been able to fit it in. And this to be honest, this has become slightly easier as our team becomes stronger. And, you know, there was a time at Rebel, you would remember those days, I would respond to every Twitter, issue. But yeah, things have become easier over time.
No, that's why I asked, because I am in that phase and finding it extremely tough to even do, you know, the base level maintenance work, forget about taking it to another level. And since, you know, we do this podcast also, you know, to bring out the whole truth of entrepreneurship, that, yeah, actually, even Jaideep in his first 3-4 years wasn't able to, you know, do this. And maybe there is, you know, sometimes we're too harsh on ourselves. And maybe there's a time for everything. The last question that I want to ask and, you know, bring this to a close with is, how does the mountaineer in you impact the entrepreneur in you, and vice versa?
I actually think, you know, there are a lot of similarities between mountaineering and building a business, and this can be said about any sports, right? But I particularly find it like uncannily similar. Let me explain. Like, you know, the adrenaline rush that you have in business while finding a new way, a new product market fit. The same rush comes when you are like trying to find a route and you're not finding it on the mountain, and then suddenly you find it and you find a new foothold while climbing a wall, or you know, finding a new gully through which you would get to the next stop. I mean, it's uncannily similar, and it is the same rush. So that's one. Secondly, I think both mountaineering and business pay for being slow and gradual. Like, there is a saying in mountaineering that you climb high and sleep low. That means, you know, you climb, put your tent, come back and sleep low. You don't rush it. If you rush it, more people die on the mountains from acclimatization than from accidents, because you try to go too fast, right? And then and in business also, there are people, I have seen it all my life, and I've seen it myself also in our business, when we try to go too fast, we are in thin air and we are gasping for breath, and then, you know, shit happens. So that's a second very uncanny similarity that I find with this. You know, it's a sport where the trust on the team has to be at the highest level. Like, here you are doing a, you know, lead pitch and someone below is belaying you. Your life is dependent on that guy, and you totally trust on that guy, right? And otherwise it's going to be a disaster. So that sort of trust building, I feel, is happens only in business, because, you know, especially in businesses where, you know, we have distributed operations and things like that, without trust, it's impossible. So I think that, I have reflected on it. And the other way mountaineering helps me is that when I'm on the mountains with the sack on my back, you know, walking upward, just lost in myself, thinking about things, there are a lot of epiphanies that have happened to me on that walk or on that climb. So it's been quite complimentary, I would say.
I can imagine the team feeling, is Bari Jaydi pahad se wapas aayega to kya leke.
Totally. And team has realized that if I go to Nepal, it's not as safe as other destinations, because Nepal, there is Wi-Fi everywhere.
Oh.
No. Okay, he's really not going away.
Not going away. the little compensation ki theek hai, jab bhi aayega, 10 din baad aayega. It's also not happening. No, but the word scaling, I guess, comes from peaks. The word that we love so much comes from peaks. Yeah. And of course, I don't know if you remember our age-old example of Sisyphus pushing that rock uphill only to watch it come down.
Yeah.
Also comes from mountains. So there is definitely a parallel for life and for entrepreneurial life in mountains. Jaydi, sure. Thank you so much. I've extremely, like, supremely loved this chat, and thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. All the best.
If you like this episode, don't forget to hit like and subscribe to our channel so we can continue making more of these. And tell us who you'd like us to host next in the comments below. Ciao for now.